Some tips for making effective presentations are: 1. Outside in instead of inside out. As engineers, we gravitate towards a verbose presentation with very many details. We want to take the audience through the same thought process/steps that we went through, in say, solving an issue. This approach is inside-out approach. The more effective presentation is the outside-in approach. Put yourself in the senior management's shoes and think what is that they expect. Address their potential concerns or questions in the first few slides. Remember, senior management have less time, so in all probability you will not get time to go through all the slides. So plan your slides should such that the first 10% of the slides cover 90% of all that you wanted to communicate. 2. Storytelling. Conceive your presentation as a story. Start with an executive summary slide to outline the story. For example, if the presentation is about describing the root cause of a project issue, this summary slide should have a problem statement, observations, root cause, and potential workarounds. You should be able to describe the debug of the issue using this one single slide. Have few extra slides to support this summary slide. The presentation approach should be that of peeling an onion. Only when more questions are asked, should you take help of the further slides. You can have more detailed slides in the backup to further support your presentation. 3. Less words and short sentences. You have to be very stingy with the words that you use. Please note that while you are talking through your presentation, the listener will be scanning your slide that is projected. Cramming it with very many sentences will lose his attention. Lesser the jargon on the slides, lesser would be the questions that gets asked. Lesser the questions, better is the impact of your presentation. 4. Visual aids. Lesser the text and more the visual aids, picture, chart, etc., more effective will be the presentation. For example, instead of showing the schedule milestones as a table, create a Gantt chart. This way, visually you will be able to explain why there is a schedule slip, which are the critical paths, and what actions, if taken, you can pull in the schedule. Even the technical results when shown as waveforms are legible, pleasing to eye and easier to convey. 5. Adapt. It is not necessary that all the slides that you prepared need to be presented. Assess the presentation review process dynamically by observing how the senior manager is responding to your slides. From the body language, if you assess that the interest on a slide is less, then quickly move to the next set of slides. Remember, what matters is not what you want to communicate, but what the senior management is interested to listen. 6. Anticipate. One of the critical steps in preparing for the presentation is to anticipate the type of questions that will come up. Every word in the slide is a source for a question. So be precise with your slides. If you know about the nature of the person to whom you will make the presentation, anticipate the sort of questions this person will ask. For example, if a person is schedule-driven, then the obvious questions that he could ask would be about the task duration, about the critical path of the schedule, and what are the ways to pull in the schedule, etc. Prepare for all such anticipated questions. 7. Internal reviews. Have couple of internal reviews with your senior managers. As they are more closer to the senior management, they can provide better perspective of the expectations from the presentation. Be open to overhaul the presentation based on their feedback. 8. Rehearse. It is good to rehearse your presentation couple of times. It helps to write the script of your presentation on a paper and rehearse it as a virtual presentation. Clinton apparently rehearsed 27 odd times the first speech that he gave as the U.S. president. Challenging the team. Chapter 22. The discipline. As a middle manager, typical feedback that you would hear from your senior management is that you are not challenging your team enough to achieve the goals. You are a lot closer to your team than your manager, and so you have a good feel of your team. You may be hesitant to challenge the team as you know that the team is already stretched. You want to be seen as a manager who challenges the team, and at the same time you don't want to come across as an unreasonable leader in front of your team. Does this situation ring a bell? So, what should you do as a leader to manage this catch-22 situation? There are a few techniques that you can try. 1. challenge the assumptions and not the commitment. Let's say the team says it needs 4 weeks to accomplish a task. Merely challenging them to do it in, say, 2 or 3 weeks to pull in the schedule doesn't help. It means that you don't trust their judgment. The better strategy is to challenge the assumptions that led them to make their commitment. Go a few levels deeper in your assessment. Maybe sequencing the order of the tasks, or limiting the scope of the task, or assigning a different resource, or prioritizing their other project commitments, or providing extra help could be different ways to address the challenge of the schedule pull-in. As a leader, you need to question the assumptions recursively till you know all options are exhausted. 2. Challenge the norm or status quo. Many a time we stick to the norm. We hear, "This is the way it was always done." Doing it the same way and expecting different result is foolish. Recently in one of the products, the quality team wanted 4,000 hours of qualification for the chip as we were using few components which were not qualified. My manager challenged the team, and so we had few calls with the process team to understand what is needed to reduce the hashtag hours of qualification. We were asked to do a few specific simulations of the components, and if they pass, they were willing to reduce the requirement. If we were not challenged by our manager, we would have blindly followed the process mentioned by the quality team, which would have impacted our schedule for this product. 3. Create, push to a corner, situation. When a person is in a comfort zone, he is not challenged enough. By creating a situation where he is pushed to a corner, he needs to come out of the comfort zone to solve the problem. He will stop thinking linearly and think out of the box to solve the problem. This situation will make him voluntarily do the above 2 steps, challenging the assumptions and norms. Recently, in one of the projects, we were working towards an aggressive schedule. There was a new design that had to be done which didn't require a very experienced resource. In the usual situation, comfort zone, to not affect the ego of the experienced person, this task would have been assigned to a junior engineer. But given that we were pushed to the corner to meet the schedule, we had to assign this task to the senior engineer. This turned out to be the right strategy for the project. The fact that this senior engineer was sensible and professional made it easy for us to make this assignment. Plan of Performance Assessment. Chapter 23. Performance assessment should first start with the self-appraisal by the employee. Even though the manager may know enough about the reportee, to be fair to him, he should have details of every one of his accomplishments. For this, self-appraisal of the employee will be helpful. When assessing the performance of the employee, the manager should evaluate not just the technical accomplishments but also the associated skills like innovation, quality, project management skill, mentoring, knowledge sharing, etc. Beyond that, the assessment of the soft skills like initiative, independence, communication, etc., should also be included. The weightages of these different skills could vary based on the grade/band of the employee. In my experience, I have seen some of the biases in the assessment that should be avoided. 1. Broad brush bias. Manager has to critically evaluate every skill of the employee. Just because an employee is good at few skills, it need not make him good at all skills. But because of this bias, many a time the assessment is skewed. An employee who is good in a few skills is rated as good across all skills, or if the employee is bad in a skill, then this bias carries forward to other skills as well. Beware of this bias. 2. Recent bias. The recent accomplishment or misses are fresh in one's memory. So at the time of assessment, one should not get carried away only by the recent accomplishment or misses. To avoid the recent bias, one should look at the whole year of accomplishment. For this, self-appraisal of the employee will be useful. 3. Promotion bias. I have seen managers assess an employee in the top percentile even though the employee was just promoted in the last cycle. The recently promoted employee should be critically evaluated in the new grade/band as the expectations of the promoted grade/band is higher than the previous grade. 4. Group accomplishment versus individual accomplishments. Organizational goals are achieved due to teamwork between many employees. Some of the project accomplishments have many owners. But for the performance assessment of the employee, one has to be critical of his exact contribution. Should be careful of not attributing the group accomplishment to an individual. 5. Group bias. When calibrating the performance of the employees across the organization, managers should be open and sensitive to assessments of the employees in the other group. He should not have unfair bias towards employees in his group. Calibrating the performance of employees across groups is a challenge to the organization head. All managers using the same template for evaluation helps in calibration. However objective the performance template is, there is still a subjectivity involved in the assessment. So one should not get caught on the exact ranking of employees, but look at clusters of employees who are of similar performance. For a fair calibration, the manager of one group should know reasonably well the employees in the other group. Active participation of managers in cross-functional project reviews would help them for assessing the employees in the other group. As a manager, you should also create opportunities for your employees to have visibility outside of the group. Performance assessment of the employee is also an excellent tool for the manager to identify the gaps of the employee. He can work with the employee to put an action plan to improve on the gaps, so that he improves his performance for the next review cycle. Managing peers and senior colleagues. Chapter 24. In the past, the leader of the organization was usually more experienced than other people in the organization. As the job opportunities in the past were limited, a person with more experience by design was more qualified to lead an organization than a person with lesser experience. In the knowledge/technology world, a person who has better skills, capabilities, and who is willing to take risks is considered for leading the organization. This person need not be the most experienced person in the organization. He can either be your peer or he can also be less experienced than you. It is commonplace these days for young leaders to manage more experienced employees. This poses a challenge to the organization, the young leader, and also the experienced employees. In this GAN session, I will bring out my perspective from the vantage point of the young leader, senior/peer, and the organization. 1. Young leader. For a start, he must have conviction that it is his skills and talent, due to which the organization reposed faith in him to lead the organization. He should not have any guilt in leading the organization or managing experienced employees. He needs to respect the experience of his peers or his seniors whom he manages. Without affecting their self-esteem, he needs to leverage their talent/experience. He needs to take them along to meet the goals of the organization. He should separate the friendship of his peers and his professional responsibilities. His peers and seniors may be earning more salary than him. He needs to accept and internalize this fact and ensure that it doesn't come in the way of his professional duties. As a first-timer, the young leader may be uncomfortable and not confident to accept this responsibility. He should not shy away from it. The earlier he takes up such responsibility, the sooner he will get better at managing his peers/seniors. 2. Senior/peer, for a start, this person should accept that his other peer or his junior is more capable to lead the organization than himself. He should also understand that his past accomplishments does not entitle him, at present, to lead the organization. Working for a junior doesn't make him a lesser individual. He should have sufficient self-esteem, in his own capacity, that he adds value to the organization. He should not worry about what others or the world think of him in this context. He should note that he is reporting into a position, the person holding this position happens to be his peer/junior. He should use his experience to help the young leader make the organization successful. If he really wants to get such a leadership responsibility, then he must identify his skill gaps and work on it. 3. Organization. The organization should promote young leaders only based on their capabilities. They should help the young leader with necessary training so that he can manage his peers/seniors. They should not make exceptions in the organization structure by not having peers/seniors report to the young leader. They should communicate to the leader's peers and seniors as to why they chose this leader and the rationale behind it. They should seek their cooperation to enable the young leader to be successful. In the event if the peer/senior chooses to quit, they should manage this attrition. Why some employees never grow. Chapter 20. One of the challenges for the leader is to hire and develop a world-class team. To develop such a team, beyond doing the right hiring, the leader needs to get the best out of every employee. There is no single solution to get the best out of every employee. But there are few common strategies that can be followed to get the best out of every employee. 1. Build trust. Employees must feel confident that their leader works in the best interest of the employee. For this, the leader should earn the trust of the employee. Through his actions, he should demonstrate that he really cares about the employee. He should display a high level of integrity and be consistent in his actions. He should connect with the employee beyond work to build a good rapport. 2. Set clear goals. He should set clear, challenging goals for his employee. He should articulate about the criticality of the goals and how it is connected to the organization's goal. 3. Provide support. Having set challenging goals, the leader should provide necessary support to the employee to meet the goals. Enable necessary connections with other leaders/peers. If mentoring is needed, then the leader should get a mentor for the employee. For timely feedback, he should give regular and timely feedback to the employee on his work. He should give constructive and critical feedback. When there is trust between the leader and the employee will be open for any tough feedback, as he knows it is only for his own good. 5. Opportunities for visibility. The leader should create opportunities for the employee to be visible. He should empower him to take higher responsibilities. 6. Reward. He should appreciate the employee's work in a timely manner. Copying the senior management in the emails for the good work done by the employee will not only motivate them, but also make them visible to the upper management. This is besides rewarding him with a good compensation review at the end of the year. 5. Management Fundamentals. This blog talks about the individual behavior and technique expected of the manager. Excerpts taken from the book, The Unwritten Law of Business. 1. Every manager must know what goes on in his or her domain. This applies primarily to major or significant developments and does not mean that you should attempt to keep up with all the minor details of functions assigned to subordinates. It becomes a vice when carried to the extent of impending operations. Nevertheless, the basic fact remains that the more information managers have, the more effective they can manage their business. 2.do not try to do it all yourself. It's bad business, bad for you, bad for the job and bad for your employees. You must delegate responsibility even if you could cover all the ground yourself. It's part of your job to develop your staff, which includes developing initiative, resourcefulness, and judgment. The best way to do this is to load them up with all the responsibility they can carry without danger of serious embarrassment to any person or group. 3. Put first things first in applying yourself to your job. Since there usually isn't time for everything, it is essential to form the habit of concentrating on the important things first. The important things are things for which you are held directly responsible and accountable. Assign these responsibilities top priority in budgeting your time. Then delegate as many as possible of the items that will not fit into your schedule. Cultivate the habit of boiling matters down to their simplest terms, the faculty for reducing apparently complicated situations to their basic, essential elements is a form of wisdom that must usually be derived from experience. Make it a practice to integrate, condense, summarize, and simplify your facts rather than expand, ramify, complicate, and disintegrate them. The mental discipline which instinctively impels one to get at the heart of the matter is one of the most valuable qualities of a good executive. 5. Cultivate the habit of making brisk and clean-cut decisions. Decisions will be easier and more frequently correct if you have the essential facts at hand. The application of judgment can be facilitated by formulating it into principles and policies in advance. You do not have to be right every time. So take a definite position and see it through. It is futile to try to keep everybody happy in deciding issues involving several incompatible points of view. By all means, give everyone a fair hearing, but after all parties have had their say and all facts are on the table, dispose of the matter decisively even if someone's toes are stepped on. 26. What managers owe their employees. In this blog, I will talk about what all managers owe their employees. 1. Timely and critical feedback. It is your inalienable responsibility to talk things over with employees if, and as soon as, you become sincerely dissatisfied with their work, or you recognize deficiencies that are working against them. This is not always easy, and it will require much tact to avoid discouraging them, but you owe it to them. Bear this in mind. If you ultimately must fire a subordinate, you may have two pointed questions to answer: why has it taken you 5 years to discover my incompetence? And, why haven't you given me a fair chance to correct these shortcomings? Remember that when you fire someone for incompetence, it means not only that the employee has failed, but also that you have failed. 2. Make it unquestionably clear what is expected of employees. Number 1 on the list of required communication between supervisor and subordinate is the explicit understanding of expectations on the job. All too often, managers avoid direct discussions and rely on implicit instructions and generalized goals. Successful managers clearly set down goals and expectations with their subordinates, then follow up with monitoring and support. 3. Do not hang on to employees too selfishly when they are offered a better opportunity elsewhere. It's bad business to stand in the way of an employee's promotion just because the loss will inconvenience you. You are justified in shielding your people from outside offers only when you are sincerely convinced that they have an equal or better opportunity where they are. Accept that you are probably unable to judge this yourself anyway, so consider soliciting the option of the employee involved. It is his or her career, not yours. Anyway, you should not get caught in a position where the loss of the individual will embarrass you unduly. Select and train backups for all key personnel, including yourself. 4. Show an interest in what your staff is doing. It is discouraging to employees when the boss manifests no interest in their work, as by failing to inquire, comment, otherwise take notice of it. A little interest goes a long way, make the effort. 5. Never miss a chance to commend or reward subordinates for a job well done. Remember, your job is not just to criticize your people and intimidate them into getting their work done. The better part of your job is also to help, advise, encourage, and stimulate them. Along the same line, never miss a chance to build up the prestige of your staff in the eyes of others. This is not to suggest perpetual lenience. By all means, get tough when the occasion justifies it. An occasional sharp censure, when it is well deserved, will usually help to keep employees on their toes. But if that's all they get, they are apt to go a bit sour on the job. Chapter 27. The danger of almost done. Procrastination is the act of unnecessarily postponing decisions or actions. The main psychological mechanism behind our procrastination is as follows: when we need to get something done, we rely primarily on our self-control in order to bring ourselves to do it. Our self-control often receives support from our motivation, which helps us get things done in a timely manner. In some cases, we experience certain demotivating factors, such as anxiety or fear of failure, which have an opposite effect than our motivation. In addition, we sometimes experience certain hindering factors, such as exhaustion or rewards that are far in the future, which interfere with our self-control and motivation. When demotivating and hindering factors outweigh our self-control and motivation, we end up procrastinating, either indefinitely, or until we reach a point in time when the balance between them shifts in our favor. Related literature in the field of psychology gives following specific reasons for procrastination. Abstract goals, rewards that are far in the future, feeling overwhelmed, anxiety, task aversion, perfectionism, fear of evaluation or negative feedback, fear of failure, a perceived lack of control, ADHD, depression, lack of motivation, lack of energy, sensation seeking, etc. In my experience and from what I saw working with many people, I saw these specific reasons and the ways to overcome it. 1. Uninteresting task. When the task is uninteresting but needs to get done, the motivation to do it is low, so people tend to procrastinate. A classic example is the documentation task. People are excited to get the job done, but not that excited to document the work. One of the ways to overcome this problem is to first accept that documentation is critical and is part of the job. I had a colleague who had the habit of documenting the work as he made progress with it and not wait till it is complete. It is almost like keeping a journal of the work done. This way, documentation doesn't become a separate task that needs to be dreaded. 2. Not clear on the final form of the task. When the task is not clearly defined or it is abstract, there is hesitancy to start and bring clarity. Examples like writing a paper for a conference or making a thought presentation. One way to get over this problem is to first come up with a skeleton/table of contents. This is one way to remove abstractness and bring clarity. Then one can plan to work on each table of content so that the final paper/presentation can be stitched together. 3. Student syndrome, the tendency to work on a task close to its deadline, like the students who usually prepare for the exam the night before. One needs to understand that Murphy's Law, uncertain/urgent event close to deadline, can play spoilsport. By setting an internal deadline which is earlier than the actual deadline, one can address this syndrome. For overwhelming issue, if the issue seems overwhelming, then there is a fear that you may not be able to complete it, so you don't want to deal with the situation, hoping that the issue will get resolved without you taking any decision. Addressing the escalation/issue that was brought to your notice about your subordinate is one such example. If you think addressing this issue is in the best interest of your subordinate, then as a responsible manager, you cannot procrastinate or avoid it. Doing a bit of preparation on how you want to structure the conversation, hearing his side of the story, reposing trust in him are few things you can do to address this issue. 5. Q2 tasks, important and not urgent tasks. The fact that these tasks are not urgent, by design, gets procrastinated. There are many examples like fitness goals, networking, etc. The only way to get over this issue is to give these tasks its due importance and amplify the future rewards of these tasks, so that it can motivate the person to work on these tasks. 6. Laziness. Among all the reasons for procrastination, laziness is the main culprit. The only mantra to overcome this is to just do it. Don't let your mind play devil, asking your intellect to delay it. As a child, I used to fear and respect my father. So, whenever he gave me a task, however dull it was, there was no choice but to just do it. Else, I would get reprimanded. I am sure many of us would have feared some person in our life. You can imagine that this person is asking you to do the task that you are postponing, and just do it. A common way to motivate yourself not to procrastinate is to reward yourself for the progress you make to complete the task. Another approach is to make your commitment to complete the task public. This will put external pressure, to save you face, to complete it. Chapter 28. Think on your feet. The idea of clear speaking stems from clear thinking. By structuring the ideas into three-part plans brings clarity in the communication. It forces you to cut quickly to the core of any subject. It will make you organize your topic into sections that flow logically into one another, and it will help you remember your facts and arguments. It will help you stay focused and concise. By making each part distinct from the other, you ensure that your listeners have digested your first idea before you give them the second. By arranging your ideas into a logical sequence, each idea builds on the previous one, thereby creating a forward-moving dynamic that helps persuade your listeners. Below is the standard format for presenting the ideas with clarity. 1. Introduction, state theme or headline. 2. Body, announce the three main parts of your communication. Part 1. Keyword, content of Part 1, Part 2, keyword, content of Part 2, Part 3, keyword, content of Part 3, 3. Conclusion recap, three main parts of your plan, echo headline. The training talked about different categories of the plan, but I felt there are three types that are mostly used. 1. Clock plan. This plan arranges topics in terms of points in time. This plan is very effective in introducing one's career. I used this when I wanted to share my experience. Broke my career into three parts, first innings in TI, outside TI, and second innings in TI. Then I concisely elaborated each part. 2. Triangle plan. This plan arranges topics in terms of three aspects. This plan is best used for fairly serious topics, to convey thoughtfulness and fair-mindedness to an audience. It communicates your ability to look at all sides of an issue. For example, if you are asked what makes one a good development manager, one can break this topic using triangle plan into three aspects: people, product execution, and innovation. 3. Benefits plan. This plan promotes, sells, convinces, and persuades. It rests on what things do to benefit your listener. If your topic is a product, service, or person, you can create a nice momentum by outlining the benefits in three parts. Focus on how the listener will benefit. For example, if you want to promote your product, you can talk about the benefits like differentiated cost, low power, and ease of use. By using any one of these plans to structure your body of communication and adhering to the standard format described above, you can bring clarity in your communication. Chapter 29. Leadership without authority. In this blog, I present a short summary from the book Leading Without Authority by Keith Ferrazzi. We are now in a fourth industrial revolution, which is so complex and fast-moving that it demands a new type of leadership that empowers all citizens and organizations to innovate, invest, and deliver value in a context of mutual accountability and collaboration. For succeeding in this new world, the ability to lead without authority is an essential workplace competency. The author coins a new term called co-elevation. It is a mission-driven approach to collaborative problem-solving through fluid partnerships and self-organizing teams. When we co-elevate, we enter into close co-creative relationships based on candid feedback and mutual accountability. With this guiding ethos of going higher together, co-elevation nurtures a generosity of spirit and sense of commitment to our new teammates and our shared mission. The resulting outcomes almost always exceed what could have been accomplished through regular channels within the org chart. Leading without authority through co-elevation requires personal qualities like generosity, gratitude, vulnerability, forgiveness, and celebration. The author talks about a few rules that help in developing co-elevation in the leaders and in the organization. In this blog, I will explore two of the rules. 1. First rule talks about the composition of the team. Who's your team? For every project or mission you are responsible for leading a much broader group of people than the formal members of your team. The most critical people to achieve the mission may not necessarily be aligned to your organization chart. Find someone you think you'll have a positive experience co-elevating with. Choose someone most likely to grasp the roughly outlined vision. Look for those you admire and want to learn from. Look for opportunities to co-create a project with this person for the learning experience and to deepen relationships. Identify someone you believe would benefit from your help. Co-elevate this person by coaching him and making a positive difference in that person's career. Face the person or problem that you're avoiding. This person may be at odds, and to establish a deeper caring relationship with this formidable colleague may look impossible. But one needs to step up and embrace this person and make him part of the team. Set aside your conviction that your way is the right way. Open yourself to the assumption that others on your team have ideas that may be far better than yours. Prioritize a list of your most critical relationships and develop a systematic action plan to nurture them. Improve the relationship continuum from resisting state to coexisting state to collaboration state to co-elevation state. 2. Rule 2, accept that it's all on you, seize the responsibility. No matter what your status is within an organization, the way to be a leader is to start leading. Right now. Do the job before you have the job. That choice is always entirely in your own hands. And the way to begin is by accepting that it's all on you. Take charge of your key relationships. We must proactively and authentically develop relationships, keeping in mind the specific tasks we want to achieve in partnership with them. Make yourself vulnerable so that you make yourself approachable. Your goal is to build genuine rapport with him. Avoid excuses like being lazy to invest in building relationships, deferring saying it is beyond your organization, or playing the victim card. You always go first. You owe it to yourself and your organization to take the first step. Co-elevation does not require consensus of two individuals having to agree. It only requires you taking responsibility to decide to be a co-elevator. Give up being right. One of the chief obstacles to overcoming resentment is giving up your insistence on being right. We are conditioned to defend our views and positions. But letting someone else to be right is the act of prioritizing your mission over your rightness. Leadership is everyone's responsibility. You must help lead your team, regardless of your job title or level of authority.